Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Arthur Sinodinos, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. When he was last here, as I recall, he was in business, and now he's here as a politician. Senator Sinodinos was educated in economics at Newcastle University. He held important positions in the Treasury Department and the Australian Public Service. He became initially an economic advisor to the Prime Minister John Howard, and then he returned to Treasury and came back as Chief of Staff to John Howard, where he played a very influential role in the Howard government. After leaving Mr. Howard, Senator Sinodinos worked in banking in the CBD. He became a senator for New South Wales in November 2011, and late last year he was appointed parliamentary secretary to the leader of the opposition, Tony Abbott. So it's great to have the senator here tonight talking on the topic of Australia and a more competitive world. Senator Dennis, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared. Before I begin my address, can I take a moment to thank you and Anne, wherever Anne is. Ah, there she is. And the members of the Institute for the opportunity to address you tonight. Together you've built something very special over a quarter of a century, and our democracy is the richer for it in terms of the thought leadership you provide and the forum you provide to people from many different walks of life and not all on the same side of the political divide. And that's a fantastic contribution and legacy. It's also true to say that Australia's political class and the wider intelligentsia have had a fascination with what is broadly described as a progressive side of politics, with a specific focus on the Labor Party. But Jared and Anne are among honourable exceptions, with their important contributions to the history of liberal or centre-right politics in Australia. Jared, through numerous books and articles, including Menzies Child, and Anne primarily through the vehicle of biography, including her wonderful book on Joe Lyons, which I'm still trying to read. And can I say that from my point of view, tonight was an opportunity to talk about a topic that's close to my heart. It's about Australia in a more competitive world. And I deliberately chose that topic because it's a broad canvas. I haven't come here to ram a lot of economic theory, a lot of economic policy down your throats, but there are some things that I am concerned about. There are things that are part of the reason I'm in politics, and importantly why I'm keen to be part of Tony Abbott's team as we go forward. And I want to talk tonight about the competitive challenge that I believe this country faces, what it means to be a liberal today, particularly how modern Australian liberalism is relevant to dealing with contemporary issues, the productivity imperative, and then some specific issues around boosting our labour force participation, reform of industrial relations, the challenge of regulation, the opportunity for investment and national development, and the need for innovation. Now, I've been a bit idiosyncratic in my choice of those topics. I haven't come here tonight to give you a policy speech, but I'm giving you a flavour of some of the matters that are particularly close to my heart. So in pursuing the sort of economic plan and program that the opposition has got, these are some of the areas that I'm particularly keen for us to put emphasis on. Let me begin by describing the competitive challenge that we face. The first point to make is that globalisation is here to stay. There is no turning back. The idea that we can somehow turn back change, we can somehow mandate job security, protect our way to prosperity, that is gone. We have to accept the world as it is. We accept that to our north and northwest there exists more than one-third of the world's population, or 2 billion people, China, India and Indonesia in particular, and they are providing us with some magnificent opportunities. But they have transformed themselves through the embrace of markets, taxation and regulatory policies that provide incentives to attract capital, physical and financial, intellectual know-how as well as enabling policies such as education and healthcare that provided their citizens with skills to participate in modern industries. They have transformed themselves. They now have economic and social policies that are fit for purpose, and they are super competitive. Now, that is creating both opportunities and challenges for us. Yes, there are the opportunities in terms of the customer base it provides for a wide array of Australian goods and services, whether we're talking agriculture, oil and gas, minerals, higher education and research, manufacturing or tourism. But there are challenges in the sense that the rise of Asia and the other big emerging economies in Africa and Latin America, who are able to produce similar goods and services to us, increasingly at sophisticated levels, at more competitive prices on the world market. So the world is changing around us, and I have a bit of a sense of urgency about this because I don't think as Australians we sometimes appreciate how much other countries are changing around us and how their economic policy frameworks have changed, and that we mustn't be complacent about the challenge that that poses for our institutions. So a greater proportion of the Australian economy than ever before is being exposed to international economic forces. And this is providing greatly expanded consumer choice. There's no doubt about that. But that is also exposing a lot of Australian jobs across a lot of sectors that we didn't expect in the past to that global competition. And so we're living in a world where if we're unable to come to terms with this continually, it appears or feels like continually increasing level of competition, transformation through technology, we are in danger of experiencing lower relative living standards over time. That is the challenge that we face. Now, it was inevitable that as less developed countries, emerging economies started to catch up with the developed world, right, relativities would start to shift. No doubt about that. But the challenge for us is almost become one of running harder just to stay in the position we are in. Consider, for example, what's happening to Australia's manufacturing sector. In the December quarter, Australia lost one manufacturing job every 19 minutes, or a total of 30,800, according to the Bureau of Statistics. Over the past 5 years, we've lost a total of 140,300 manufacturing jobs. Now, the government will say the exchange rate, other factors at work, but the fact of the matter is that our inability to produce high-quality manufactured jobs at globally competitive prices is hurting us. Now, I'm not here with a brief for one particular sector of the economy. I'm here to talk about these forces in the economy-wide context. But I believe there can be a future for manufacturing as well as other sectors. Just because other sectors grow in relative importance in our economy does not mean that a sector like manufacturing has to go down in absolute terms. In a growing economy, we can have growth across all sectors. It's just the shares, relative shares, may change. So I'm arguing we need to respond with a greater sense of urgency to the competitive challenge that confronts us. And we must respond positively with an attitude that accepts change and seeks to manage it in a way that maximises our prospects in the years ahead. In my maiden speech, I spoke about embedding a global mindset in the community and at all levels of government. And for us, the challenge is to raise our national productivity, embed that enterprise and risk-bearing culture, as well as making innovation the preferred way of doing business. Now, in this context, what role should Australian liberalism play in steering Australia through this more competitive global landscape? I mean, John Howard regularly invoked the metaphor of the broad church in describing the presence within the Liberal Party of both classical liberal and conservative strands of thought. Australian liberals have a proud history of conserving the best of the past and making the reforms necessary to create a better tomorrow. And we prefer managed change without surprises, and we want our reforms to stick. And we understand that the essence of successful political leadership is striking the balance between keeping what works and fixing what is broken. And in my own case, my own experience, particularly of the Howard government, is that we need to make real efforts to make reforms stick. We did some things well, other things we did not do as well, and I've reflected on that experience, and that's why I say we need to manage change without surprises. And that means taking the Australian people into our confidence regarding our plans for change, consulting stakeholders, setting out a clear program and direction for arriving at the desired outcome. In setting out the case for reform, we must communicate clearly the benefits, face up to the costs, and explain why, on balance, we can be better off as a result. Tony Abbott has been emphatic that he will keep his election promises. Having campaigned on Julia Gillard's broken promise on the carbon tax, the public can be assured that Tony Abbott knows that he must put all his plans for government on the table before the election and seek a mandate. Now, Australian liberalism is a demanding philosophy. It emphasises opportunity and aspiration, as well as personal responsibility. I don't see an inherent conflict between any of these goals. In today's Australia, most of us are firmly aspirational. We want to do better and be recognised and rewarded for it. The language of class warfare has no place in modern Australia. It harks back to an era that is now long gone, an era more associated with the Cold War, the White Australia policy, and an inward-looking, protected Australian economy. Economic activity is not a zero-sum game, and it's possible for labour and capital to work together to create a bigger pie. In recent years, the economics and the politics of redistribution have dominated Labor's policy framework. Labor has taken the resources boom for granted. Based on Treasury projections, they actually seem to be projecting that the terms of trade and the income growth that would go from that would just keep going on and on and on. They treated it as the contemporary equivalent of the cargo cult mentality. And under pressure, Labor has been obsessed with how to distribute the ever-diminishing gains from things like the mining tax into more and more consumption spending. In sharp contrast, our commitment to the market system, to personal freedom, as well as personal responsibility, is, we believe, a better framework for grappling with the modern competitive world. I believe that our framework, our values and beliefs, put us on the right side of history. For Australia to thrive in this more competitive world, we need to come to grips with the productivity challenge facing our economy, what I call the productivity imperative. Now, this is not a call to sackcloth and ashes or personal sacrifice. People hear the word productivity and they think, oh, we're all being asked to work harder or work for lower wages and benefits. No, that is not the case. An increase in productivity can be achieved by producing an increased amount of outputs using the same level of inputs or by producing the same level of output using fewer inputs. In either case, incomes can grow, creating new demand and jobs. Improvements in productivity can be achieved at the firm level by changing work practices, business processes and systems that deliver the same operational outcomes with less effort. At the macro level, the improvements in productivity can be achieved by streamlining compliance requirements or eliminating unnecessary regulatory hurdles and providing high quality and efficient infrastructure to allow the efficient movement of people, goods and information. The McKinsey Global Institute, which has done work on this subject over 25 years, concluded in 2004 that differences in productivity between nations virtually explain the differences in gross domestic product per capita. And looking forward, without the stimulus of further growth in our terms of trade, Australia needs to increase productivity to sustainably increase our GDP per capita, our income per head. Since 2007, GDP per capita growth has only been one-third of the growth in GDP per capita of the Howard era, partly reflecting the fact that the stimulus in the terms of trade has shifted around. Moreover, as indicated by Tony Abbott at his National Press Club address in January, what we call our multi-factor productivity, how we use our labour and capital, the efficiency of using them all together, has, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, actually declined by 3% since July 2007. Now, productivity is full of all sorts of measurement issues, and there are reasons why productivity can go up and down. But the fact of the matter is that you put that together with other studies which show, for example, the Economist Intelligence Unit in August last year, a study that ranked us as second worst of 51 countries for productivity growth. These show that our productivity has declined, particularly in the last 5 years. A McKinsey study of our experience in income growth between 2005-2011 showed it was driven by rising terms of trade and an upsurge in capital investment, but the obverse of that was that labour productivity was weak and capital productivity actually fell. That study found that among our major capital projects, which are prone to inefficiencies and cost overruns, there is scope to improve project performance by up to 30%. So that will boost our level of gross domestic product per capita and our living standards. Let me provide you with an example of some of the roadblocks that we find to higher productivity, and it's from an area close to my heart. It's from Australia's health and medical research sector. Earlier this week, the Shadow Minister for Health and Ageing, Peter Dutton, and I issued a press release highlighting the fact that Australian scientists in 2012 spent the equivalent of 500 years of cumulative time, or $66 million of annual salary costs, on preparing grant applications to the National Health and Medical Research Council, of which only 20% were successful in obtaining approval. Now, surely in 2013, you think an advanced country like Australia could find a more efficient way of allocating funds for public research. Now, this is only one example of excessive red tape, but there are countless more examples across Australia in a variety of industries. So we regard the productivity imperative as a coalition as one of our most significant policy challenges. Tony Abbott talks in his Real Solutions for All Australians policy framework about a multifaceted approach to addressing this issue. He talks about getting the budget back in the black to create more room for the private sector, boosting workforce participation, driving efficiencies in government service delivery, cutting green and red tape, enhancing competition, delivering infrastructure with greater efficiency, and reforming industrial relations law to provide greater flexibility. One area I'm particularly interested in is labour force participation. We believe there are opportunities to encourage a much greater number of young people, seniors and women to participate in the workforce. The Grattan Institute, in a recent report, Game Changers, Economic Reform Priorities for Australia, indicated that boosting workforce participation among young people, seniors and women would boost our GDP by tens of billions of dollars. We have committed to creating 1 million new jobs in 5 years and 2 million new jobs in 10 years. Ultimately, boosting workforce participation means providing everyone with the opportunity of a good education that allows them to play to their strengths and get a job, build a career and start a great business. As Liberals, we believe that the best way we can help people to stand on their own 2 feet, exercise personal responsibility and be truly free. And so for us, the social safety net is there to help those who, for whatever reason, are unable to help themselves. But it's also there to act as a springboard for getting others back into work that best suits their talents. The worst outcome is to perpetuate welfare dependence, which saps initiative and self-esteem and establishes a cycle of intergenerational poverty that sees kids growing up in households where no one has worked for one or two or three generations. According to the Australian Bureau of Stats, in June 2011, there were 1.2 million jobless families in Australia. Some 19% of all families. Of these, 910,000 were jobless couples families, or about one in every six couple family, and 290,000 jobless lone parent families, or almost one in every three lone parent families. Now, these statistics are quite disheartening, and there's no evidence, to the best of my knowledge, that this situation has materially improved over the past 2 years. Now, I believe increasingly core business for the coalition is how to promote the economic social benefits of work and to provide genuine pathways from welfare to work. And that underpins a range of initiatives that we pursued under the Howard government and that Tony Abbott is committed to pursuing further. And I believe they will be a hallmark of his leadership should we be elected to government. Tony was here at the Sydney Institute, I think last Friday or the Friday before, he spoke about his commitment to addressing Indigenous disadvantage. Well, for us, that is a microcosm, and they're the most disadvantaged group of our society, but it's a microcosm of addressing this problem across the board, because as Liberals, we want everybody to participate in the broader benefits of society. So for us, it's core business. So it's about how we remodel the system from passive to more active income support. Both sides of politics have made, I believe, strides in this direction. But one of my passions is that we need to keep that process going and make it more all-inclusive. Part of this process is also helping parents, particularly women, better manage modern pressures of work and family. Now, you may be aware, unless you've been living under a rock, that Tony Abbott has promised a genuine paid parental leave scheme and ensuring that childcare is more accessible, affordable and flexible. But the truth is that women continue to be treated with either a conscious or unconscious bias in many Australian workplaces. In many cases, they are still locked out of the centres of decision making and leadership. They continue to be paid less than men for the same work, and work too often remains inflexible to allow them to do everything that a 21st century life demands of them. It's also true that women remain woefully underprepared financially for retirement. According to ASFA, the Association of Superannuation Funds of Australia, it reports that 9 out of 10 women have insufficient super to support a comfortable retirement. They continue to care for younger children while now caring for older family members. They get caught being the sandwich generation. And return to work strategies that better cater to the needs of women to make up for lost time and opportunities for advancement because they've been outside the workforce remain elusive. The reason I particularly mention these is that we have tried over the years a whole series of strategies in both the public and private sectors in dealing with some of this, and what I'm saying is we haven't quite got it right yet, and it's something that I believe is important unfinished business, particularly if we are genuine about giving women the opportunity to be full participants in the broader society. And it's a challenge for all of us who are married and who rely on our partners to help us get ahead, but it has to be reciprocated, and I think this is something which both sides of politics need to keep working on. Let me turn briefly to industrial relations reform. It's a bit like Hamlet without the prince. On industrial relations policy and the need for reform, as Liberals, we don't regard trade unionists or working Australians as the enemy. When we contemplate change in the structure of industry and the labour market, we believe it's in the best interest of workers and the economy to equip them to respond to change rather than hold out the false hope that change can be avoided and that governments can mandate job security. Too often this government has sent out the message that it can do things to in effect stop the tide of change or insulate people from change. The fact is, people are more empowered, people are more confident about themselves if we give them the tools to deal with change in a confident, open way. Creating a well-trained, flexible workforce is the best form of job protection for Australians. Unfortunately, this government has turned back the clock on industrial relations to a time before Paul Keating's changes in 1993 that ushered in enterprise bargaining. Labor also believes in a one-size-fits-all approach, a uniform approach across industry sectors, and seeks to insert third parties into processes that can best be left to those directly affected. Now, Gary Banks, the retired chairman of the Productivity Commission, who's now at the Australian New Zealand School of Government, was reported as saying recently that Australia's current industrial relations arrangements are the most pervasive source of red tape, which inhibits the ability of businesses to innovate and adapt over the long run. Now, the Coalition has already announced we will bring back the Australian Building and Construction Commission to restore law and order to building sites, as well as ensuring unions and their officials have the same standards of accountability as companies and their directors. And the restoration of the ABCC could create up to $6 billion in productivity gains based on the experience of the previous Building and Construction Commission that Tony Abbott set up when he was Minister for Industrial Relations. Now, we understand that the community as well as Labor's own review of the system acknowledges that the Fair Work laws have created problems around militancy, productivity and flexibility. And we will say more about how we address these problems in the run-up to the election. And I reaffirm that our approach on industrial relations will be cautious, prudent and practical. Tony Abbott has made it clear that there will be no return to work choices. Let's not have more of that scare campaign. We will not say one thing before the election and do another thing after. But let me reiterate the point. Industrial relations is part of a suite of policies for setting us up for a more productive and flexible future. That is why we are prepared to take on the mantle of more reform in this area in the years ahead. But as I say, no one will be mugged. People will know before the election what we are doing afterwards. But industrial relations reform is part of a broader group of policies around lowering the regulatory burden in our society. The Coalition Deregulation Task Force, which I chair and which included Senator David Bushby and the member for Higgins, Kelly O'Dwyer, has been around the country for the last 12 months talking to diverse industries, businesses and managements about the burden of regulation. And now you'd expect me to say that business are concerned about the amount of red tape, but what has surprised me is how uniform the chorus has been and the perception that business has about how much red tape has grown over the last few years. And people in business link it back to the attitude they find from government, which is very much one of, if I can quote Kevin Rudd from his maiden speech, which he reiterated at the height of the global financial crisis when he was attacking neoliberalism, when he talked about putting government at the centre of the economy. There is a golden thread that runs through a lot of Labor policies, which is essentially that Canberra does know best. Now, it may be a trite point to make that Canberra does not know best, but the reality is that there has been a concerted effort over the last few years to increase the amount of regulation of the economy, often at the behest of particular interests. And despite having a commitment to a one regulation in, one regulation out policy, Labor has introduced over 21,000 regulations and only removed about 100 since 2007. Over 73% of survey respondents in a recent survey for the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry believe that the overall burden of red tape has increased in the past 2 years. And those of you who watched Senator Conroy at work a couple of weeks ago on the media laws will know the extent to which the government believes that more and more red tape run from Canberra is the best way to run the economy. Our ranking on the burden of government regulation, according to the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Index, has slumped from 68th in the world in 2007 and 2008, which doesn't sound like a big or a great starting point, I have to say, to 96th in 2012-13. We are committed to reducing the burden of red tape initially by about $1 billion per annum, starting off by repealing things like the carbon and the mining taxes. In the case of the mining tax, even though it's not yielding to date great revenue, it's imposed significant compliance burdens across the whole of the coal and iron ore sectors because they've all had to gear up for it. In the case of the carbon tax, there's a whole bureaucracy associated with that, all sorts of rules and regulations that you'll be perhaps familiar with. But our point is we are starting off by picking off some of those major ones, but it's a commitment to $1 billion. It'll be driven by the Prime Minister, a red tape reduction unit within the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet to provide a whole of government platform for this work. We have a particular interest in also dealing with what we call green tape. We want to maintain the high environmental standards that we have in Australia, but the impact of green tape is felt when companies and projects are required to comply with overlapping and often duplicated environmental project approvals. You may have read in the Australian newspaper on Monday that the costs imposed from green tape place at risk more than $200 billion worth of projects. Export projects, particularly in the oil, gas and mining sectors. Some time back, Tony Abbott and Greg Hunt, the shadow spokesman, in seeking to reduce the costs imposed by green tape, committed the coalition to the establishment of a one-stop shop for environmental approvals. And such an approach will simplify existing Commonwealth bureaucratic arrangements, creating a single approvals process for all environmental approvals via the state system as part of long-term agreements with each state and territory government. I think there's a lot we can do in the regulatory space. Some of it actually involves more work with the states. Some of it involves greater mutual recognition between Australia and overseas jurisdictions, where they have standards of regulation that we regard as cognate with ours or corresponding to ours. There is no need to duplicate processes here if countries that we regard as having comparable standards have previously looked at and regulated and approved or accredited particular projects or systems or goods and services. I want to deal with infrastructure and innovation because I think they're two elements of this continuing push to promote our productivity. But my point here is that we are keen to facilitate investment across a whole range of industries. And one of the things I worry about is that with increased global mobility of resources, the competition to attract foreign capital, both in terms of financial, physical, human and intellectual know-how, is becoming more and more critical. While debate on the role of foreign investment and the size and composition of our immigration program should not be suppressed, we should eschew xenophobia and the temptation to stoke the fears and insecurities of Australian workers. And this is what Labor attempted to do with its demonisation of Section 457 skilled immigration visas. We need foreign capital and the best and brightest migrants we can attract from wherever they come across the world. The global competition on both these fronts is more intense than ever. If you look at the way the Americans, the Canadians and other jurisdictions go out of their way to try and attract people, this is something that we have to make sure we are front and centre on. We pride ourselves on being an immigrant nation, our tolerance, our multicultural society, our great lifestyle, but we need to make sure we send consistent signals about immigration and the size and composition of our program, of the program. Tony Abbott is committed to entrenching a lower tax economy that provides incentives to work, save and invest, but our approach to doing that is through equivalent reductions in government spending, facilitated by the elimination of waste, unnecessary duplication between tiers of government, and more efficient service delivery via greater contestability with the private sector and not-for-profit providers. And this is a model we want to distribute or disseminate as widely as possible through government activity. This is exemplified by our commitment to devolve the responsibility to hospital boards and school councils and principals for running schools and hospitals. It's underpinned by our belief that local control supports more effective decision making and greater responsiveness to community needs. It's an approach that was first tried with the Job Network. Now, Australians understand that we have an inadequate provision of infrastructure in certain areas of the economy. Urban congestion and the underutilisation of rail freight services means that Australians, particularly those who live in capital cities, are spending larger amounts of time stuck in traffic rather than using their time productively, either at work or with family and friends. This has been an area where traditionally the coalition has been a bit wary. We gave the states the GST in the early 2000s and essentially said, you've got your state responsibilities, which cover transport and infrastructure and the like. Commonwealth has a certain role, but you have the main role in urban and regional development, and we'll leave you to it. But increasingly we are finding the Commonwealth having to take a role in helping to provide master plans, if you like, and I think Greg Hunt spoke at the Sydney Institute about this at one stage, master plans for how our cities grow and develop, and the integration between transport, infrastructure and land use planning. And we are elected, we are committed, if elected, to partnering with the private sector to build the modern infrastructure our country needs. This should be supplemented by greater access to private capital on the proviso that we are making the most efficient use of existing infrastructure assets. There is no point in continually talking about increasing the amount of the infrastructure spend if we are not making the best use of existing assets. And we've seen at the Commonwealth level through the work Infrastructure Australia has done that there are many assets at the state level that could actually be sold and the money for that used or recycled into creating better, more modern, new infrastructure. And certainly where we can as a Commonwealth, we should facilitate that process. We've already committed to using Infrastructure Australia to develop a 15-year rolling plan with project priorities and delivery timetables, as well as empowering Infrastructure Australia to develop to deliver better value from infrastructure spending through better governance and transparency mechanisms. No more commitments to spend $40 to $50 billion, because it's now getting towards $50 billion, on the national broadband network without proper cost-benefit analysis. Now, there was an argument with the NBN that you couldn't really specify all the benefits, that there were direct benefits and then indirect benefits, and really, in a sense, build it and they will come. But the fact of the matter is, given the size of the spend we are now talking about and the potential opportunity cost of that in terms of other projects foregone, you have to ask the question, there must be a more rigorous way to do this. And that's why we've made the commitment to empowering Infrastructure Australia to take more of this coordinating role. One area related to investment I particularly want to highlight is that in the 60s and 70s, under coalition governments, there used to be a Department of National Development. And that made a statement that the federal government had a commitment to the development of the whole country. Now, you could say, well, that's implicit in what we do and all the rest of it. Well, yes, it is, except, for example, look at Northern Australia. Some of you will be aware we recently, by a circuitous process, a paper was released talking about potential coalition plans in terms of Northern Australia. But our point there is we're not seeking to replace the market. We're not seeking to, through some centralised planning process, say we've got to develop Northern Australia in this or that way. But what we are saying, in sympathy with market forces, as a national government, we can develop and identify national priorities for development. And one of those priorities has to be the role of Northern Australia as a gateway to Asia and how we better harness the resources, including the water, in Northern Australia. It can't be that hard. There are a lot of people I meet who come to Australia who say, well, fantastic country, a lot of people here in this southeast corner and increasingly coming to the cities, but why aren't you developing the north? Isn't there a plan? What's the vision of the country? Now, I'm not saying that developing Northern Australia is the vision for the country, but it is a component of the vision we have about what this country can be. And when you link that with the rise of China and India, and when you link that with the resources and opportunities that are there, yes, it's easy to say, but the environment is fragile, but there are infrastructure issues, and there'll be this or that issue. But if you work on that basis, was it Blaxland, Wentworth and Lawson, would they have ever gone over the Blue Mountains? That is the issue. And that's part of the reason why I think we as a Liberal Party in particular need to re-embrace the credo that we believe in national development. The final component I want to talk about is the need for innovation. I won't say much except to say that in today's world, the future belongs to the innovators, to those who create sustainable competitive advantage. And that means in a world where we increasingly accept that the dollar is going to stay high, much longer than people expect, we can't rely on just cutting costs, the exchange rate moving a favourable way to promote goods and services. We need to see around corners. We need to have a capacity to innovate, to create sustainable competitive advantage. We've been successful in certain areas, exemplified by Cochlear and ResMed, but in comparison to our national competitors, we have gaps when you look at the links between academia, public sector research, venture capital, capitalists and entrepreneurs. The best innovation seems to be when you're able to bring these various sectors together, to work together. Finally, may I say, in my maiden speech, I remarked how the coalition had made the right calls on the big issues of the last few years, the extent of fiscal stimulus, border protection, the carbon tax and so on. Importantly, the coalition did not turn its back on the Howard Costello legacy of rigorous and consistent economic management, working to a plan and being pragmatic but on the road to achieving the desired policy outcome. I think that is a function of having so many of our front benches as people who worked in that government and absorbed that approach. We're all committed to strong economic management as providing the basis for a secure and prosperous Australia. We understand due process and the importance of collective decision making through the proper workings of Cabinet and the value of genuine engagement with those affected by policy proposals. Above all, we have the discipline to stick to a plan and not indulge in navel-gazing or internal party games. And Tony Abbott has led by example. He has put us in a potentially winning position. We now must stay the course and deliver a government worthy of the great Australian people, and that is you. Thank you.
So once again, thanks to Westpac for their facility this evening, and I'll be very brief. When Arthur Sinodinos was last here he was a minister, and he spoke about Australian politics, and he's back here as a senator and speaking predominantly about economics, and it's very clear that he has a great grasp of the whole issues of economics, economic reform, Australian economic history, as well as his other interest. I thought it was a very encouraging effort tonight. If Tony Abbott's going to become Prime Minister, it's pretty clear that Arthur Sinodinos is going to play an important role. So it was refreshing to have you here tonight, 6 months before the election, talking about matters, I think, of interest to all of us, particularly the whole concept of regulation. So once again, many thanks, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.